So we have one reading this morning. I changed my mind late on Friday and just shrunk it down to one. It's from the writer Brian Doyle, who is a teacher and a writer and a poet and a soul brother. Howard Teibel and Alex Bussinger will read it for us.
I, Brian, a simple suburbanite, a generally decent sort but subject to fits of unrelieved selfishness, do wish here to confess and be forgiven. So then, I have taken seats on the bus reserved for the elderly and weary when I was neither, and I have stolen shampoo and notepads and pens from motels and hotels, and even a Gideon's Bible, and stolen fast ranks of teas from conferences and seminars, that's true, by the way, and towels from pools and gyms, and much else from Aegis of Bowerings, knowing full well that I would never return the contraband. And I have even in this way stolen obscure paperback books from the shelves of friends, a confession that makes me so uncomfortable that it must be true. Obsecro ut mihi ignoscus, I beg to be forgiven.
Also, I was for many years sneering and dismissive and vulgar and rude to my parents, never once even seeing the pain I inflicted, never once thinking how it would feel to have raised and coddled a child with a serpent's tongue. And not until I was 19 did I feel a lash of remorse. Obsecro ut mihi ignoscas, I beg to be forgiven.
Also, I actually did for years take my lovely bride for granted, more than a little. I did think that being married meant that she would never leave me, and I could drift into a gentle selfishness that she would have to endure, because she had sworn in public before many witnesses to be true in good times and bad, in sickness and in health, to honor all the days of my life. I carry those words in my wallet, but I did not look at them enough and contemplate them and mull them and take them deep into my salty heart. Obsecro ut mihi ignoscus, I beg to be forgiven.
Also, I have roared at my children and snarled at them and made cutting remarks and teased and razzed them past the point of gentle humor. And 1,000 times I have spoken to them sternly of what they have not done rather than sweetly of what they have done. And I failed to contemplate their dreams, especially when their dreams were far from the dreams I had for them. Obsecro ut mihi ignoscas, I beg to be forgiven.
There are many more things under heaven that I could here confess, but I'm going to use that lovely excuse that time grows short and the end of the paper draws near. So I beseech you to ascribe many sins, large and small, to me and leave them nameless, except to the Spirit who knows every feather on every arrow. And assume my guilt and my apology, and say in a small voice but with a wild heart, Obsecro ut mihi ignoscus, I beg to be forgiven.
So what do we think of their Latin? There is a terrific thing on Google where you can go in. It's called Google Translate. And you can type in the English to Latin or the Latin to English, and then you just hit the little speaker button, and it tells you how to say it. So Howard left me a voicemail. Was it yesterday, Howard? speaking this Latin into my phone. And I must admit, having grown up Catholic, as you'll hear in my sermon, that I had reverberations. It's like, who is that talking to me? And Howard, I think you liked the power, actually, didn't you? Yeah. All right, some statistics first, okay? In a country where almost nothing is agreed upon, let alone 94% of us, a new survey called the Survey of Love and Forgiveness in American Society, finally a survey worth taking, says that a full 94% of us want to see more forgiveness in our country. Vast majority. It's encouraging, isn't it? And a full 62% of that 94 said they need more forgiveness in their personal lives, which, if you do the math, means that 32% crave forgiveness in the world, but think, you know, it's got nothing to do with me, actually. It's everybody else who's the problem. All right. You scratch the surface of that survey a little more, and what you found is that while researchers in our country found that in our country, most people want forgiveness, more than half, 60%, said there are situations where people should never be forgiven, including abuse, including sexual crimes, and also murder. Also, researchers found that 60% of people, again, believe forgiveness is conditional on the offender apologizing or making changes. Okay, so just to review, 94% want more forgiveness, but some of us don't need it in our personal lives. Some of us don't think it covers certain situations, and some of us have some conditions on that forgiveness. And then, if you scratch the surface a little bit more in this wonderful study, what they found is that most people seek out friends and family more than religious leaders when grappling with issues of forgiveness, which hurts a little, but I'll forgive it. And 1 in 4 said they did not know where to go for help with their spiritual needs. 1 in 4 don't know where to go. And 1/3 of that number say they struggle with spirituality, whatever that word means. And although most Americans are not running to church and religious professionals for guidance with forgiveness and other personal issues, the researchers found that 60% of Americans said they are now more spiritual in their lives than they were 5 years ago. So last week I quoted Emerson's line that to be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something different is a terrific accomplishment. Great quote. And reading the survey this week and all of its contradictions, another quote of his comes to mind. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Note that the word foolish is the most often dropped word in that quote. So, let us, you and me, take not our little minds, our large minds, hobgoblin-free minds, into this unwieldy, so cliche, loaded, contradicted, sometimes conditional, easy to say but so hard to do, deep, thorny, ridden with pain, but freeing, and so full of grace, vineyard, that are the vineyards of forgiveness. Our January theme is this spiritual practice, and it comes just in time for the new year when the calendar tells us we get to start over. But even when we said goodnight on the 31st and we woke up on the 1st, our lives are the same, our burdens are the same, our patterns are the same, our grudges are the same. And rather than preach to you or at you, I want you to think of me kind of like how Deb and Glenn were in the back. I am just your usher this morning to these vineyards. I'm just your usher. And I first want to introduce you to a man named Malcolm. And he's like in the fourth row of the vineyard. And he's all the way in the back. And you don't know Malcolm. There's a good chance you don't know him, but there is a good chance that you heard of him. He lives just down 27 in Wayland. And ever since his beautiful 17-year-old daughter, Lauren, was killed by her boyfriend, Nate, 2 years ago, Malcolm has lived every day in the vineyard of forgiveness. And he's sitting there remembering Lauren, who is spunky and quick with laughter to help cure Malcolm of his over-seriousness. And he says that she played the French horn beautifully, even though she hid it from all of her friends. She said, "It's not cool, Dad. It's so not cool." Malcolm says that people have sometimes thought he is not raging inside over what has happened to Lauren. And he says that is utterly wrong. "I just find places to do it by myself," he says. "I head out to the woods in Wayland, and I just bellow and moan." Meanwhile, Malcolm, who is a member of the First Parish Unitarian Universalist congregation in Wayland, and whose minister, Ken, I sat with 2 years ago as he prepared for this service, 2,000 people in the church over the town green. And Ken, who's been in this work for 40 years, saying, "I don't know what to say." Meanwhile, Malcolm is picking through the thickets of that vineyard as he tells a Boston Globe reporter that he has to learn how to go underneath the anger. He says, "I hurt terribly for what has happened, and remarkably, on both counts. I care deeply about Nate." I want us to hear that again. "I care deeply about Nate. And I care what happens to him. He's got such a hard row. But I want to be open to forgiveness in as many situations as I can. It's so incredibly rough in this one," he says. "But it's still a question of understanding for me. And something better coming out of it." And what Malcolm has done is work with teens who are in relationships and figuring how to make up and break up and be safe. So, Malcolm, in the vineyard, meet the 60% of us who say that forgiveness should never be given in a case like this. 60%ers, please meet Malcolm. What is there to say except just notice each other? Notice Malcolm bellowing in the woods. You know, if you drive through Wayland Center, you might even just hear him. But notice also how he's getting underneath his anger. And you're thinking, and I'm thinking, is Malcolm a saint? And my answer is that sometimes I think that we confer saintly status on people so that we can let ourselves more easily off the hook of having to try to follow their example. That's true for me. So instead of a saint, maybe we can just think of Malcolm as a broken-hearted dad whose broken heart has somehow broken open. All right, can we picture Malcolm? Another row in the vineyard. I want us to meet Maggie. You don't know Maggie, but you may recognize her. Because Maggie is a composite, she's an amalgamation of all the people that we may know, maybe recognizable to us in the mirror in the morning when we look at ourselves, who just wrote her burden or her grudge down on a piece of paper and put it in the backpack. And the kids are downstairs reading them now, wondering who they belong to. What has she written down in the paper? Maybe it's about the dad who drinks too much, or the spouse who slings verbal arrows every morning at her, or the friend who dissed her at Friday night's party. And who could forgive and would forgive if only that father or that spouse or that friend were actually sorry. But they're not. At least they never say they are. And how do you forgive someone who never apologizes? How do you forgive someone who never changes? How do you and why would you? Now, sure, Maggie listens to her pastor quote the Bible, that enigma of a book that in one place says an eye for an eye, and another place says we ought to forgive 70 times 7, which means without limit. And sure, Maggie walks in the CVS aisle and sees the cards that say forgive and forget, and that in reality make her want to rip up that card in rage, because any reasonable person knows you just can't forgive something like the dad who embarrassed you at dinner with friends because he drank 3 martinis in a row and then called your mother a name and made her cry. And made Maggie cry too in the car alone later by herself. The thing is, though, with Maggie, is that she carries around this anger and it just tears her up inside. It occupies, as the quote says, rent-free space in her mind. And it's anger that bubbles out of her in the most unlikely of places, at the kids in the checkout lane, as they take lifesavers off the rack, at the driver who just cut her off, at the politicians on the TV who disappoint her so, and she wakes up in the morning and hears herself screaming at the TV. And so Maggie, because she's got nothing else to do, walks into the vineyards of forgiveness, not so much to forgive her dad or her spouse or her friend, but to forgive herself for not being able to let it go and seeking the strength to have a hard conversation that will mean confronting the person who has caused her pain and saying, no more, I love you, but no more, until you can change. There in the vineyard, Maggie is learning that forgiveness does not mean glossing over the truth in the religious equivalent of putting lipstick on a pig. No, she's learning that forgiveness means holding someone accountable, even as we seek to offer them pardon. First comes the truth, then comes, maybe, the reconciliation. So we have Malcolm, and we have Maggie. And finally, all the way in the back row of that vineyard, sits Father O'Malley. True name, not made up name. Irish Catholic priest, salt and pepper hair, sideburns down to here. And in a moment remembered from the past, he is there with his hand held gently on top of the crown of a head of a young man that is bowed in front of him. All 4 of their eyes are closed, because just a moment ago, this young college-aged man, this once-upon-a-time Catholic man, walked from across the college campus that's across the street and told Father O'Malley that he wanted to receive confession for the first time since he was 13, and even then it was forced. Why? Because he was feeling so angry and hurt about a friendship that had turned ugly and hard words were said. And this young man knew he had wronged his friend and wronged himself and was feeling so guilty, which, my friends, is not always a bad thing. Because guilt is what our conscience and our soul uses to poke us to become the people we say we want to be. And yes, guilt can be taken too far, but it is possible to let guilt wake us up without beating us down. There's a difference. So there's Father O'Malley, and there's the young man. There I am. That's me. Eyes closed, head bowed, Father O'Malley's hand on my head. Why am I there? I can still hardly believe that I went to him. Why am I there? Because I needed to know that nothing under heaven and earth was going to keep me from being loved. Not even the ways that I had hurt my friend, using my serpent's tongue. Did I apologize to this person? Of course I did. Did I make amends? Of course I did. But I somehow needed more than that. I needed to reconcile with myself. And Father O'Malley, sitting there with me in the pew face to face in this quiet Catholic church on a Tuesday morning, he helped me do that. He put his hand on my head and he said something like, "Audir hanc confessio," hear this confession, "and vos es ignoscas," Nathan, you're pardoned. The Latin somehow adding weight to the weight I felt inside of me. Once a Catholic, always a Catholic, I guess. Which, as I get older, bothers me less and less as I learn to let go, as I learn to forgive the grudges I keep against the former faith that was my home. I commend the practice to you. And the point here, please hear me, the point is not that there is a judging God sitting above this sanctuary who holds her or his own grudges against us and waits to forgive us until we are ready to beg for it. Because that is its own kind of conditional love. That is its worst kind of theology. No, the point of my going to Father O'Malley was that I can be reminded by another human being that my failures as a friend didn't mean that I was a failure forever, which in my 19-year-old insecurities I truly believed. In this way, you could say I became then a true universalist, because as Father O'Malley removed his hand from my head and smiled warmly into my eyes, I felt for the first time the saving message that all are worthy and all are welcome and all are loved and all can be reconciled. And when I say all, I do mean all. If my job teaches me anything, it is that. So are we ready to be uncomfortable? Don't answer that. Let me invite you to take a risk with me and rise in body or spirit. I, and say your name. I, a most simple suburbanite and generally decent and loving person who at times is subject to bouts of selfishness and pettiness and cynicism and hold more grudges than I care to admit, do wish here on the second Sunday in January to seek forgiveness. This slight act of self-improvement being exactly the kind expected of us when we say in the sanctuary that religion is less about what you believe and much more about the person you are. So then, we who in moments of deep frustration and impatience have blared our horns at the person driving in the Acura in front of us, and after they just cut us off and are now driving 10 miles below the speed limit, and we called them a name that we teach our children never to say or even to think, and even though it was rude on their part to drive so carelessly and stupidly even, what is striking is how easily we can forget there is a person behind that wheel with loves and losses and favorite foods and dreams and disappointments just like us. And so with a contrite heart, with the promise of our universalist faith, we say nothing in heaven or earth can separate us from love. Say it with me. Nothing in heaven or earth separates us from love. And for all of our best intentions to be good friends to our friends, we did share that one time gossip and forgot to call our best friend when she was homesick with the flu. And we made some judgments about people and their appearance. And we held people to higher standards than we could meet ourselves. And we jumped to conclusions based on no evidence at all. And while hiding behind humor, actually flipped words like whips and chains upon those who were not deserving. And have amused ourselves with dark remarks. And have amused ourselves at the expense of others, sometimes under the guise of laughter. And so with a contrite heart, with the promise of our universalist faith, We say nothing in heaven and earth can separate us from love. And even though we hear the preacher say that we are asked to be good stewards of the earth and each other, we have fallen short. Who doesn't? And we dumped the oil from the oil change out back behind the fence when no one was looking. And threw away plastic bags instead of recycling them because we couldn't be bothered to take the extra step to the store. And more than that, we pretended not to see the homeless man who tried to catch our eye in Natick Center. And then later on, at a dinner party that night, complained to friends how everyone seems to look out only for themselves. How is it that we can love the earth and each other and the world and our children so much that we can barely find words for it? How is it, then, that we have such a hard time translating that love into our lives on Monday morning? And so with a contrite heart, with the promise of our universalist faith, we say, nothing in heaven or earth can separate us from love. And there are, as Brian Doyle says, so many other things that we could confess here this morning. But let us use the lovely excuse, the time grows short and coffee hour beckons us, and it is time to sing the final hymn. And so we beseech each other to loosen our grip on the grudges that we have as we march together into 2013 and walk together the vineyards of forgiveness and meet Malcolm and Maggie and Father O'Malley in our lives, because they're there. And say together in a small voice, but with a wild, wild and free and full of grace heart, nothing in heaven or earth can separate us from love. Confessio, agnoskos. Amen.